Hey everybody, it's time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy. My name is Max and I'm here with Stacy, and we're in New York City, and it's now day two post Brexit. Stacy.
Well, it's not even 24 hours, is it? Well, you know what? You guys Brexited and I am so surprised. I was shocked. I didn't expect it. Did you expect it, Max?
No. You know, the Scottish referendum was a damp squib. The general election of 2015 proved the shy Tory, so-called, was out there keeping the status quo alive. Then you had the Queen's birthday and the Queen's salute and the Queen this and the Queen that, and the Prince is here and the Prince is there. I figured, nah, they're not going to Brexit because they're inebriated. But it turns out that they were inebriated, and that's why they did vote Brexit. Apparently, the day after they Brexited, a lot of people went to Google to search what is the EU in a hangover state from having imbibed too much during the vote.
Well, you know, lots of things in the media are exaggerations. So I think that, you know, personally, I'm just happy it's over with because I was so exhausted, and I wasn't even participating, but I was exhausted from the headlines, the shrieking headlines from both sides of the aisle, and you know, saying all sorts of apocalyptic things would happen. By now, of course, you know, Russia should have invaded and stock markets collapse. Well, you know, stock markets did fall, and some shares in like house builders fell by up to 50%, which
Well, this is a big question I have, you know, yeah. Because we've been asking on this show for for years now, been tracking the property bubble. You know, it's been the number one topic of conversation in this country for a decade. It is the single greatest generator of wealth. It's the basis of the rentier economy. And the question is, when would it pop? And because trees don't grow to the sky, because things have a life and then they die, and property bubbles come and they go, and this one in the UK and in London had to end sometime. I don't see why we can't categorically say that this property bubble in London has now ended. I mean, all the signs are there. What are your thoughts?
You know, I guess what people are saying, what they think, what the market participants believe, is you already had the top of the market falling. And the top of the market were primarily, the buyers were Chinese and Russian. So that was already falling partly because of the sanctions against Russia, and then China's government cracking down on corruption and theft of money. So a lot of the top end was just looted money from other countries. And the bottom, or you know, the sort of say 500,000 to the 2 million pound range, a lot of that, it appears, I guess, market participants were thinking this comes from French money, Spanish money, Italian money, Greek money, you know, the wealthier of those countries that flee before their banking systems collapse. So perhaps they think that there will be less of this, but there was nothing, you know, the Chinese and Russians were able to buy, so I don't see why the, you know, other nationalities can't buy.
Right, you got the foreign money coming in that has propped up the property market. The property market has been subsidized from the government with schemes like Help to Buy, the Right to Buy, of course, under Thatcher initially got it rolling. You have many George Osborne schemes. Now, George Osborne is out. Cameron is out.
Has George Osborne officially resigned yet?
No.
Okay, well,
I'm jumping to that conclusion.
Okay,
Cameron is out. Everything with Cameron, you know, is kind of being swept out, I would imagine. Okay, so you have that. You have the government subsidies have added, you know, and the banks, for example, HSBC offered a 2-year mortgage, 100% mortgage for less than, it wasn't 100% mortgage, but it was you had to put up 30%, but it was for less than 1%. So it was 0.99% was the mortgage. So the property market's been supported by these lower rates. Rates have gone down, down, down. Mm. Now, in the city of London, the gilt market, the treasury market, has been going down, as have the global bond market. because central banks have been actively buying back securities to keep these prices low, to keep the Ponzi scheme going. But, you know, part of what we're saying here is that the 35-year bull market in bonds is over. That would definitely kill the UK property market because financing costs are going to go up. What was the first thing, the first call you got after Brexit was from your friend in France who has a buy-to-let property in London, who is very concerned that this might be the end. In other words, this market is on a knife edge. And these people that are living off the income, they watch this very closely because it's a key to the overall economy. And once rates start going up, because if the City of London loses its monopoly position in finance, which I think is a fair statement post-Brexit, as the business starts flowing to Frankfurt, their costs start going up. So the rates, that means it going up, up, up is the same as inflation. Inflation means higher rates, which means property bubble puncture.
You know, another argument that is being made now is, you know, the Remainers were calling the Leavers. And I do want to note, by the way, that London overwhelmingly went for Remain, as did Scotland. And the rest of the country voted exit, you know, to leave, which was surprising. Apparently cities like Sheffield voted leave and they were expected to vote Remain. So, you know, the rest of the country voted for leave. But now a lot of the Remainers are saying this is about racism. And I believe it was somebody like David Cameron said yesterday, or somebody from his party said, now people aren't going to be able to intermarry, you're not going to be able to live in Europe, all sorts of crazy stuff. But, you know, here we are in New York City, and I wanted to point out that you can set your own immigration policy. You can accept all sorts of people as you determine. It doesn't matter that you're part of the EU or not, because yesterday Max and I took the D train, and Max has never taken the D train in all the years he lived here, certainly not out to Brooklyn. We went from Bryant Park all the way out to 55th Street in Brooklyn, and I told Max, look around the train. It was so remarkable to see a huge cross-section of humanity on this train from every single race and nationality you could possibly think of seemed to be on in just these two carriages that we were sitting in. And, you know, here the United States is not Europe. They don't have, you know, they're not an amalgamation of various states and of free travel, but they just accept free travel. They accept immigrants from around the world. I don't understand how you can suddenly say just because you're not part of the EU, suddenly nobody's going to be allowed in. You still set your immigration policy.
Yeah, look, the problem that's kicked off this Brexit debate going back a few years was the expansion of the EU in Brussels to, I think it's 27 countries at the moment, and expanding to more countries gives all these countries instant access to Britain. And Britain is an island with, you know, physical limitations. And so this is what kicked off the debate. It's unlike America, which has millions and millions and millions of acres
uninhabited.
That's just in the middle of nowhere. You know, Britain is a very small place. You can go drive from one end to the other in 2.5 hours. It's one state essentially of America with 65 million people.
Yeah.
So this is kind of what kicked off this policy, because waves of immigrants come into the UK, and you know, people that they flood in, and suddenly the social structure is put under some strain. You know, they it's just a law of physics more than anything else. You just, you know, so that's what kicked it off. Now, they in the UK, they will have an immigration policy with quotas, or like Australia or whatever, they'll have a different model. They'll have different policy. They'll accept immigrants, but they have to do so in a way that doesn't cause too much of a strain on services, and so that's kicked it all off, and that's their goal, right?
So, the other thing that Barack Obama yesterday said, last night he said that he blamed globalization on this, that this was the cause of this Brexit vote, and you know, that's kind of what I said on our show, the Kaiser Report, our special that we recorded yesterday, which is that there are, as Henry Giroux said on Kaiser Report a few weeks ago, you know, there are a lot, many participants in our, not our economies, but just our societies are disposable now. They're no longer actually needed. And you only ever really see them now during elections, during votes. So there is this weird thing that, like, you see during the Trump vote or here during the Brexit vote, is the urban elite, the urban, sophisticated, creative classes are definitely, there's more and more conflict brewing. And you see that even from the creative classes, what you see them say, and I've seen this over and over. I saw it on Twitter. I see it in the U.S. I see it on my Facebook page regarding the Trump voters, is that the urban elite are really getting angry with the disposable, unemployed, used to have great job, heartland sort of living people. They are starting to say, we don't want the vote anymore. We don't want these, certainly we don't want these people to vote. So I find that quite remarkable as well. This is a new trend I see.
Well, yeah, the you mentioned a couple of things there. The this was a populist uprising, which you know, you wouldn't expect in Britain. You know, you saw it in Athens, you saw it in Cairo, you see it in America. You don't expect it in Britain. But Britain, this was a populist uprising meant to get rid of Cameron, because people knew that if they voted to leave, Cameron would resign. I think that's the only thing people were thinking when they voted. Not a single other piece of information went into their thinking other than, let's kick this guy out of office. And even people who casually voted for leave, you know, the interviews post-election, there were a lot of people who said, well, I voted leave, but I didn't actually want to leave. But it was just a little, for me, it was a minor show of protest. It was a bit of a protest vote, but I didn't figure we'd actually vote to leave. And that bubbled up into a full-fledged movement. So this is a populist uprising. And it will require a lot of work. As I mentioned going into it, you're going to have antagonism between Britain, yes, and continental Europe. So in continental Europe, they've already said a couple of things, like, one, please leave immediately. We're not interested in talking to you anymore. And this is going to be a contentious divorce. You know, there is a lot of it's a divorce, effectively, and it's a messy divorce. And who owns what? Who gets what? All of the economic assumptions that were made by the Leave campaign in terms of how much money is going to be saved by leaving, mm-hmm, this, at the end of this divorce, all that will be well gone. There, mm-hmm, won't be any savings, and it will cost. And it will cost a lot, because the UK is going to be the big loser in this divorce.
Well, there's also the divorce between London and the rest of the United Kingdom, well, the rest of England, and also Wales. It seems like, as an outsider kind of observing how the UK runs, it's like all policy is about London. The government is about London. It's almost like, oh, you know, it's a surprise sometimes to learn that there's anything outside of London. The fiscal policy, monetary policy, political policy, it's all for London. Whereas, you know, there are places out there called like Manchester, Sheffield, Hull, you know, Birmingham. There are other places, and you would never ever know that. Liverpool, you would never know that.
There's incredible bigotry in London toward everyone else outside of London. More so than...
Even France.
Yeah, you see it in France. The Parisians are hated by those living in Provence, et cetera. And the New Yorkers get a lot of flack from people in Texas. Okay, but here in the UK, though, it's much more... It's deeper. And the people in London are openly contemptuous of those living outside of London, and slurring them and libeling them and insulting them and treating them like foolish children. And so what happened is people in London were arrogant enough to think that the stupid people in the provinces, if given a vote to kick out Cameron, wouldn't exercise that vote. Well, guess what? They did.
Yeah, but also, you know, this notion of disposable people, as Henry Giroux called it, forget like the average Londoner. I know they're like snobs, say like Parisians, but the actual political class, the people who rule the country and rely on votes, they seem to think that I never hear them mentioned. Like, they don't even seem to consider anybody outside of London in their political equation. Whereas in France, almost the entirety of the political thinking that goes into making decisions in France, whether it's President Sarkozy or President Hollande, seems to be about the people of the terroir, people in Provence, people in Brittany. They really, those people outside of Paris actually control more politically in terms of what their desires are than what Parisians. Whereas in the UK, it seems only what the Londoners want and need gets determined, and all the allocation of all the capital of the country, whereas the capital, the actual value, the capital, the cash, the assets of the France go toward the countryside, and it's the opposite in the UK.
Well, there's a pretty obvious reason for that. Every Parisian eating in a 3-star Michelin restaurant,
yes,
touches the countryside with every forkful of food, because France is an agricultural country. It is known for its agriculture, its wine industry, obviously, and its tourism industry driven by agriculture. Whereas in the UK, it's not an agricultural country. It is used to be into mining. It used to be manufacturing. It's now purely financial. And nobody outside of London is needed to make the financial city of London work. So they are disposed of. They're disposable. They're unneeded. No one thinks of them except during some quaint little football match where, like, Leicester City wins the Premier League, you know, and then the people remember, oh, Leicester, oh, it's so cute. Those people, you know, they actually exist. I had forgotten about them. Oh, it's wonderful. And then they're forgotten about again.
Yeah. Well, I just think going forward, you know, I guess we consider ourselves part of the urban elite. Of course, we only live in cities wherever we go. We're more of that.
Well, we were living in the countryside for a few years in France.
Well, I wouldn't consider that the countryside.
I suppose not.
The Côte d'Azur is not the countryside, Max.
Yeah, I guess. bit of a stretch there.
but to your New York City mind, I guess that is the countryside. It's like, oh my God, there's nothing open after
midnight.
There's
nothing here but this quaint little fishing village full of billionaires. This must be the countryside.
Well, no, but I'm saying, like, going forward, you know, we can't hide the fact anymore, and we must confront it, and we must debate it, and we must have a conversation about the fact that globalization has, you know, has left many people behind, has done us very well, has done many people in the cities very well, and also thanks to central banks, of course, monetary policy has taken over where our governments no longer act, right? They only impose austerity, if anything.
But the warnings against globalization, all the protests at the G8 meetings,
yeah,
the G7 meetings, all of the, you know, these are, the warnings have been out there for,
yeah,
15 years, 20 years.
Of course.
Okay, now all the warnings, it's not a matter of us waking up to the fact that the warnings or need to be listened to. It's us understanding that the ramifications of what was being warned about are now here.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying is now we seem to be at this, from based on the sort of tone I'm listening to and I see in social media, whether it's about the UK Brexit vote or the US Trump vote, is I see only both sides just filled with vitriol and hatred for the other side. There's no sort of understanding. There's only dismissal, and those people are thugs, those people are fascists, those people are ignorant, those people are racist. Like, there's no sort of conversation about the underlying causes and the situation in which we're in.
Well, here's my question. So we live in London, we live in the UK, we work there. one of my frustrations mm-hmm. has been the social unease that we're talking about here is very easily dismissed by the elites, by the ruling class, and by the house media outlet, the mm-hmm. BBC. So in other words, when you bring up these issues, it gets tisk tisk lovey. Oh, it'll all be fine. Have a cup of tea, dear. It's very, 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 dismissive. So my question is, now that this is raged out into the open, is this going to be more difficult for the elite to simply brush this under the carpet as they always do and pretend like there's not a raging class war? Because if that's true, it'll be a lot more interesting living in Britain, because people will be able to express their views and it'll gain traction. It could actually even be reported on the BBC, or there'll be more media attention to the fact that there's a raging social unrest and it's out in the open. Is that that's my question.
Well, I think that's also another issue here is the media. The media's role in both the situation in the US and here in the UK, which is in the US, first of all, you have the media problem there is different from the one in the UK. Well, the problem in the US is that almost all of the media, all the journalists live in either Washington, D.C. or New York City in these bubble urban elite centers. And the ones in D.C. are very close to power. And they cannot possibly see that the friends that they have drinks with after, you know, after work could possibly be corrupt or anything like that. So that's why you have that. And they were all in their little bubble of like, Trump is an ignorant, stupid, racist thug and he'll never get in. Whereas in the UK, you have this weird, yes, they're very, especially the BBC, you know, they're very close to power, but they also have this false, unbiased thing that they're supposed to be fair and balanced sort of thing. And I think the fact that how the markets reacted, like when the pound sold off the most ever in its history in one day, when it fell over 10%, that is caused by the fact that nobody knew. Even all those investors had one way bet. They all said it was going to be remain. That's what they thought the result was. And that's because also this so-called fair and balance that the BBC has to present everything as if they're not allowed to analyze it and say, well, it looks like when we travel around the country, it's remarkably all leave. If they say that, that's an opinion, and they're throwing the election and blah, blah, blah. It's like everything has to be like tiptoe. Oh, we can't tell you what we actually see. We have to paint a picture that looks all equal.
Yeah, the word they use is impartial.
Yeah.
This is the word impartial used by the BBC is the same as Fox News using the phrase fair and balanced. BBC is not impartial. And for the reasons kind of that you suggest there is that they're trying to be so impartial that they become very partial.
Yeah.
Because they're not actually, climate change is a good example. If 99 people say climate change is real and one person says it's false, on the BBC, you'll have that one person debating one person, and it looks like there's an impartial discussion about climate change where it doesn't actually, from a news organization, give the more accurate picture that there's a 99% certainty of man-made climate change disaster. They don't report on that, even though that's the news, those are the facts. They will try to be quote-unquote impartial, and in so doing, present a false narrative.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the audience itself, many people in our societies, there's a sort of closing of the mind, whether it's all those students at universities across America who need safe spaces, or here, you know, we weren't the earliest, but we did see quite early on that Trump look like he could possibly win. And that's when he started to win. Then we really looked at the economic situation and all the unemployed men across the middle of America, whether it's Ohio or Illinois or Michigan or Pennsylvania, we saw that these people were going to vote Trump. And just by uttering that, you could see some comments on our early YouTubes calling that Trump would win, is that that you are therefore saying you're supporting him. Why are you? This is propaganda. All we were doing is stating that he was going to win. The obvious facts, by the obvious situation of all these disposable people, they have a voice in the elections, and they're going to make that voice, even if it's to blow up the whole thing, because this is a powerful statement to make.
So, well, speaking of Trump, you know, his comments on the Brexit, he was in Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
Saying that, you know, a lot of more people will come and play golf on my golf course. And yeah. Now the mainstream media attacked that as being trivializing the importance of this event. But I would argue that in a world economy where it's driven almost entirely by consumers and consumption and debt, the behavior of consumers and tourists is the most important piece of the global economy. He's making a profound point there. The cheaper pound allows more tourists to come to Britain. And well, many of them will play on his golf course.
Well, I'm sure, actually, this Brexit vote, you know what? We're here in New York City, and it's covered all over the place. And people are like, what the heck is Brexit? Britain? Where is that? Well, you know, I'm sure it's like free advertising.
Exactly. Well, let's explore that for a second. So
we have 2 minutes.
All right. Well, the cheaper pound makes exporting from Britain more viable.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if I were a 25-year-old British person getting out of university, there's a fork in the road. Either A, I go to the City of London and become a spiv and spin derivatives, as the people have been doing now for 25 years, or B, I open a factory and start manufacturing shoes or something else. What choice would you pick? I think you got to go, what?
Yeah, go ahead.
You got to choose manufacturing. That's the new era. That's the new Britain. It's not going to be derivatives wielding.
Well, it's the locavore scene, just like what they did in Russia when their ruble collapsed and everybody started doing local production.
Yeah, they made local cheese. They made local production. I mean, that's, if that happens and there's an industrial revolution part two in Britain, then Brexit will be a genius move. If everyone just kind of sits back and hopes for the better and reverts to type, which is that the British people are by nature just miserable, getting rained on and drinking at the pub all day, then it'll be a disaster.
Well, many people are saying the other thing is, like, these areas of the UK which voted for leave also receive a lot from the EU. But remember, a lot of those EU funds actually go to people like the Queen, because she's the largest landholder. So it's only going to landholders to not produce certain crops. So that's kind of, you know, it's not like it went to the assistance of the ordinary person. Again, that's the conflict between the urban elite and the non-urban elite. So that's it for this episode of The Truth About Marxists.
The Truth About Marxists here on Residence 104.4 FM with Max and Stacey. Until next week, bye, y'all.